Hello there, and welcome to the latest edition of The Front Page. And goodness, we've got a lot to talk about this week because we had major, major racing over the last few days at Punchestown as the Irish jump season came to a close, and at Newmarket as we watched the first two British classics of 2024. We'll be looking back on the action at Newmarket and Punchestown and also discussing some key developments on the gambling legislation front in both Britain and Ireland that occurred last week. And I shall be doing that, and I'm Lee Mottershead, in company with the Racing Post industry editor, Bill Barber, and our deputy Ireland editor, David Jennings. First of all, Bill, hello.
Good morning.
Now, DJ and I have been spending a lot of time on racecourses in the last few days. I guess you have barely left your luxury home studio.
You'd be correct. Yes, I had hopes to get to Ascot on Wednesday, but some rather important announcements were made by the Gambling Commission and Betting and Gaming Council, so that knocked that on the head. So no, I've been chained to the desk, typing away manically.
With Mrs. Barber and the children supplying occasional meals at the door?
Yes, yeah, they've been very good, to be fair to them.
Well, busy time for Bill. DJ, Punchestown, for those who haven't been, it's great as a race goer at Punchestown, but for anyone working in the press room, they're pretty long days there, aren't they?
They are. I always feel bad giving out about stuff like this because it's, you know, we're in a privileged position to be
Absolutely.
Working at these meetings. And it was a terrific week, but yeah, I was tired on Saturday night now, I have to say. I came home and, as is always the case in these situations, I think when Aoife thinks when I'm going to these festivals and that I'm going to actually Barbados on a holiday for the week, because the minute I get home, it's like, here's the kids, you were away, how to enjoy yourself all week. And I have to say, I was enjoying myself because it was a very enjoyable week and some terrific performances. And I suppose we'll speak about it later in the show, but we've become so used to Punchestown being Willie Mullins' playground. This week, he played a bit, but he didn't play on every single ride. It was very much a case of, you know, the love being spread around a little bit, with Martin Brazel obviously winning the big race again, the Punchestown Gold Cup with Fast or Slow. And then, of course, Jack Kennedy was crowned our champion jockey for the first time. So, yeah, very interesting week, very enjoyable, crowds up, a lot of positivity at Punchestown League.
Yeah, well, lots to talk about Punchestown. And in terms of positivity, Bill, as we come to you for the opening story, big developments on the affordability checks front. What did we learn last week?
Well, I suppose what we learned is really where we're going with affordability checks over the next 12 months. So 12 months ago, the government published its white paper, which included these very controversial proposals for affordability checks on punters. And in the interim, the Gambling Commission has run a consultation on those proposals. We were supposed to actually find out what their response to that consultation was at the end of March, but things have slipped a little bit. But on Wednesday, we got that response. And we also got an announcement from the Betting and Gaming Council that I'll go on to that's sort of linked with that. So basically, what we got from the Gambling Commission is what's going to happen with these checks. So you've got two tiers, basically. One that they describe as light touch checks that are going on anyway at the moment when operators look at, you know, check to see if you've got any county court judgments against you and things like that. So those will kick in, those light touch checks, they'll kick in from the end of August. At a higher rate than the headline rate, 500. If you make net deposits of 500 quid a month, then these checks will kick in from the end of August. And that figure will be reduced to 150 quid from the end of February. The big deal, the one that's been exercising punters and racing due to their effect on racing's income, are the enhanced checks and when operators start asking you for personal financial documents. So the government and the Gambling Commission have promised that they will introduce a system of frictionless checks for the vast majority of people, which won't require punters to be asked for documents. So these frictionless checks are going to be piloted again from August, probably for 6 months, and basically it'll be using data from credit reference agencies. And at the end of the 6 months, the Gambling Commission and government will see how successful those frictionless checks have been in not, for the vast majority of people, not resulting in people being asked for bank statements and tax returns and things. So that will run till the end of February. They'll have to look at it. So, in about a year's time, we might know exactly where we're going with it. But we've got a direction of travel at least.
And Bill, during that period of travel, at what level are punters going to be impacted by enhanced checks in the interim period and then during the pilot period?
Okay. Well, I mean, basically, during the pilot, there won't be any impact from the frictionless checks.
The levels, in effect, have been scrapped, halted.
Yes. So basically, they'll decide on the sort of the thresholds once the pilot's over. But what we do have is what I mentioned earlier. There was another announcement on Wednesday from the Betting and Gaming Council, who have been working with the Gambling Commission on basically an interim code on affordability checks, because although they haven't officially been implemented, operators have been doing their own sort of ad hoc, inconsistent checks on punters asking for documents for some time now.
At different levels.
Yes, at different levels. Most confusing for everybody and costing, annoying punters, costing racing millions of pounds in revenue.
Yeah.
Finally, after months of talks, an interim code has been introduced which will sort of smooth out these checks at much higher levels than had sort of been mooted in the white paper. So basically, the only time people would be asked for documents for affordability checks under this interim code would be if they'd made net deposits of more than £25,000 in a rolling 12 months. So, there are an awful lot of people who don't think affordability checks should be happening at all. So they won't be particularly happy with it. But it does at least get rid of that inconsistency. It sets out in black and white what operators should be doing while the pilot of so-called frictionless checks is going on.
And that £25,000 level is vastly higher than the Gambling Commission and government's initial proposed level.
Yes, absolutely, which was £1,000 in a 24-hour period and £2,000 in a 90-day rolling period. So yes, they're much higher. I mean, there will be net deposits of £5,000 a month. Operators will be expected to have an interaction with a customer, so they might phone them up and speak to them, do a questionnaire, ask them to set deposit levels. So, but it's still sort of much higher level than the thresholds originally proposed in the white paper.
And all that being the case, Bill, what we discovered last week in terms of the interim level and then what we have learned about the pilot scheme, do we count that as a big win for racing and for those, not least the Racing Post and our readers, who have been campaigning so hard against affordability checks?
Well, the interim checks will, I mean, I think, yes, I think the various people will see that as a degree of success, that finally the ad hoc checks, there should be a uniform system. I mean, as I say, there will be people, a lot of people who just think that the affordability checks shouldn't be happening anyway, and they won't be hugely happy with it. On the face of it, the Gambling Commission and the government have, in terms of the pilot, have listened to racing and to punters' objections to being asked for documents. But there's still an awful lot of water to go under the bridge, I think. It would be a very qualified success. Again, just sort of returning to the interim code as well.
Yeah.
I think I wrote at the time that racing would welcome this because as I say,
it's a big smooth number, 25,000.
Yes, absolutely. But I was disabused of that notion.
Were you?
Various sort of WhatsApps that evening because, I mean, one of the numerous unresolved issues here is the fact that racing wanted the levy to be reformed.
And to be announced at the same time as this.
Exactly, exactly. And it hasn't been. I mean, those talks have been dragging on without very much progress, seemingly, for the last year. The Culture Secretary, Lucy Fraser, put out a ministerial statement last week basically saying that they were disappointed that racing and betting haven't been able to come up with an agreement on levy reform, because the government has basically left it to those two.
Because the government doesn't want to get involved.
Yes, exactly. So the government has sort of given a deadline on May the 22nd for that to happen. They've said that they'll then explore legislative options, but they've previously said that there's no legislative window for levy reform. Racing doesn't believe that's true. But racing believes there's ways of doing it pretty simply. But
well, I was going to ask that, Bill. So in terms of what racing wants in terms of increasing the levy rate and incorporating bets placed by British punters on overseas action, is it the government's position then that they would need to make legislative changes for that to happen?
Yes, I believe so. But I mean, there's various different ways of making legislative changes, and racing thinks that it would be there's something called a statutory instrument, which is secondary legislation. Which basically, they believe that you just need to reword the current legislation very simply, and Bob's your uncle. The betting industry disagrees, and so far the government has shown quite a lot of reluctance to do so.
And Bill, just returning to the checks as well, then, in terms of where racing will sit during the interim level, during the interim period, is there still that fear for racing that although lots of, in inverted commas, normal punters won't now be caught up with the checks, those punters, the big punters, the ones who stake the most on horse racing betting and therefore the ones who contribute most to racing's finances will still be caught up?
Well, yes, there's that, definitely. Racing is unfortunately quite reliant disproportionately on those big punters. And there is another issue that's still got to be sorted out, which is anti-money laundering checks. Now, they will continue. They're done on gross deposits rather than net deposits, and it's a sort of a similar level to the ones for affordability checks set out in the white paper. So with anti-money laundering checks, there are talks currently going on for a code for that, because to basically make sure that those sort of punters who are sort of seen as lower risk on the money laundering front don't basically get caught up, because the last thing really anybody wants, as well in racing certainly, is for punters to think, oh well, I'm not going to get asked for documentation now, and then they are asked for documentation, but it's not under affordability checks, it's under anti-money laundering checks.
Because it does seem perverse from the outside that you could have these two separate systems of checks taking place at the same time at different levels.
Yes, but I mean, I will caveat this with saying I'm not yet an expert on anti-money laundering checks, but I think it's sort of set out in legislation, anti-money laundering checks and proceeds of crime, stuff. So there isn't really any choice when it comes to anti-money laundering checks, but hopefully there will be a way of, as I say, sort of smoothing out the process for those who are seen as being lower risk.
Okay. Just before we go to DJ, who's got gambling matters to talk about of his own from Ireland. At the end of last week, based on all we knew and all we discovered, yourself as an expert commentator on all this.
That's very kind of you.
That's what I did. It's all sincerely meant. Are you more positive about the situation for punters and for racing, or in terms of cab, are you still thinking that what happens over the next few months and then during that pilot scheme period could yet yield further real concerns for the industry?
Oh yeah, unfortunately yes.
No champagne corks being
no,
popped.
No, absolutely not. There's all sorts of imponderables really. By the time this pilot finishes, we're likely to have a new government.
Well, yeah.
So, and they, you know, they will be, along with the Gambling Commission, the ministers will be responsible for deciding whether this trial is a success or not. So that's one imponderable. Basically, they've said, if we can't have these frictionless, if these checks can't be proven to be frictionless, we won't have them. But it's still not very clear how that's going to be decided, so that's, you know, it might be a case of, although the Gambling Commission has said it'll be very transparent, it might be a case of them marking their own homework. And then later this summer, there's another sort of cloud approaching, in that the Gambling Commission is bringing out called the Gambling Survey for Great Britain, and that's likely to set a figure for problem gambling rate, which will be much higher than the ones that we've been operating under. And that problem gambling rate, which might be maybe 10 times the figure that's currently being used, that will inform the regulation of the industry. So it could be that this figure is likely to produce a flaring up of the debate over gambling in all sorts of ways, and that could lead to the Gambling Commission tightening up again. There's an awful lot still to be sorted out, basically.
So still real concerns in Britain, and that is absolutely the case in Ireland as well, DJ, because there were developments last week in the Gambling Regulation Bill, and if you are someone representing Irish racing or a viewer of Irish racing, wasn't necessarily good news, was it?
No, terrible. Terrible would be the word I'd use there, Lee. Terrible. I have a little lamp here, and you can see the light kind of coming out. And over there, you have a little bit of light in the last 7 days. It's starting to look, I know it's only small chinks, but it's a little bit of light coming through. Over here, it's not looking good. Conor Fennelly, our excellent Irish reporter, had a piece with Matthew McGrath, who's an independent TD for Tipperary, and he confirmed that it has gone through the final stage, the Irish Gambling Regulation Bill, which means now it goes to the Seanad. And when these bills go to the Seanad, it's, by the sounds of things, it's almost unprecedented that it will go back a stage. So it's basically just dotting the I's and crossing the T's. And it looks like the vast majority of the regulation, the points that are in it are going to be processed, and that obviously is desperate news for those of us who Irish racing with Racing TV, Sky Sports Racing. So it's not looking good. It looks as though this ban on advertising from 5:30 a.m. in the morning to 9 o'clock at night is definitely going to be put through, which raises huge concerns. We've spoken about this for the last couple of months. Both channels have come out and said, it's financially unviable for us to continue. So I've spoken to Suzanne Eid, the CEO of HRI, about this on numerous occasions, and she keeps telling me under no circumstances will racing not be shown on Irish television screens, be it Racing TV or Sky Sports Racing. She assures me, she keeps making that same promise, but where the funding is going to come for these meetings, I have no idea. Last week it was interesting in the Dáil, because James Brown, who's putting through this legislation, he was you know, given plenty of flack in government. Piers Doherty over here, you know, put the point across to him that you know, local GAA clubs who are, you know, trying to raise funds for maybe a pitch or a dressing rooms or whatever, and if they want to run a raffle or some kind of a draw or an event, that they can't actually advertise on their local radio stations or anything like that, and or in local newspapers or any that kind of stuff. And that's the thing that really started to hit home. I think it's only now that, you know, people who are not interested in racing are realizing that actually some of the points in this bill are actually really going to affect their everyday lives. And, you know, GAA over here is just massive, you know. It's the heart of every single community. And if communities are starting to get hit by this gambling regulation bill, it's going to get very, very serious indeed. And, you know, it goes to the Shannon now, and it seems to be that maybe potentially, reading Connor's piece with Matty McGrath, that, you know, some of the points that was picked up on that side of things about your local draws and stuff, that there could be small little amendments made to those type of things. But certainly the ban on gambling advertising on specified racing channels is not going to be changed. And the next step now, Lee, is just going to try and find out exactly how racing is going to remain on Irish screens, because I have no idea how, and I don't think anybody I've spoken to has any idea how either, because, you know, the chiefs at these two channels have said, well, we can't do it because we've no money to do it. It doesn't make any sense for us to do it. So we won't be showing, you know, racing in Ireland. So how we get the funding to show racing in Ireland, that's probably the stage right now, Lee.
And if those representatives, DJ, of the two racing channels are true to the word, because I suppose you might say, looking from the outside, that a game of poker is being played, and their bargaining position is strengthened if they say, look, we just can't do this, we can't broadcast into Irish homes if this legislation is enacted. If they are true to the word, and they don't, for example, if RMG doesn't suddenly increase subscriptions for racing TV members, if they are true to the word, and if Suzanne Eade is true to her word, what options has she got? Could we have a situation where, in effect, the Irish taxpayer has to start subsidising the coverage of Irish of racing into Irish homes because of a bill that's been presented by the Irish government?
Yeah, it's like, when you put it like that, it's just the most bizarre scenario that's unfolding. Who knows? Like, who knows exactly? Like, I've tried to, you know, figure out the way that they're thinking. And obviously, I'd imagine it's been a while now. They've known for quite a while that that this scenario is likely to unfold. Like, even, you know, a couple of months ago, maybe, or even before Christmas, you're kind of thinking, oh, it could happen. But, you know, there's still these various stages that has to get through, and surely common sense will prevail, and they'll realise this is a, you know, multi-million euro industry in Ireland that caters for so many jobs in rural Ireland, and you know, this can't happen because you can't just blow up a whole industry because of this, and, you know, common sense will prevail. But that started to, that kind of view started to go out the window, you know, maybe, you know, 6 months ago or whatever. And so they basically had 6 months to prepare for the fact that meetings with government officials haven't been going the way they've wanted for the last 6 months. And they're starting to realise that, okay, this guy is not for changing, James Brown. He's, you know, I remember speaking to somebody high profile enough over here, an owner, and he said, for James Brown, this is like Micheál Martin. Micheál Martin was the Minister for Health when the Ireland was the first country to bring in the smoking ban. And, you know, that was his baby. You know, he could say that he was the one that cured Ireland of smoking, so to speak. And I suppose in a certain way, maybe that's the way James Brown is thinking as regards gambling. You know, this is maybe his smoking ban. But it's extremely worrying. I don't know what they're going to come up with. You know, we've discussions in the Racing Post, myself, Richie, Connor, you know, we're trying to figure out what the next move is going to be. So when it goes through to Shannon and it's signed into law by the president, you know, what's the next move now? Because that's what we're thinking of. What's the next move? Where do HRI go now, and what do they do? And because we need a little bit of certainty now, you know, there's so much uncertainty. We need somebody to say, right, this is what's going to happen. This has happened. It's obviously a huge backward step, but in order to move the industry going forward, and you know, at the minute, you know, you see Cheltenham, you see everything that's happening in the world of racing at the moment. I know it wasn't a great weekend for Ballydoyle at the Guineas, but in general, Ireland is thriving as a racing industry at the moment. And then you've got this massive blow to the industry that's happening right before our very own eyes right now. So we need a bit of certainty, and hopefully that certainty will come in the next couple of weeks. But who knows, Lee, your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, and I think right now, probably all we can do is guess, wait and see. Before we move on to the next story, Bill, just quickly, you referenced the Irish situation with gambling advertising in your column last week, and just reminding people that although gambling advertising hasn't really been a big discussion point in Britain during the legislative process here, that could always change.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, I'm pretty certain that campaigners are going to go in hard again on gambling advertising. It's really been, it was the one sort of controversial area the government didn't really address in the white paper. I think especially with this new survey coming out and the problem gambling rate, that's going to change, and who knows what a new government will do. I think it's hopefully the message about, you know, racing and greyhounds being a special case when it comes to sponsorship and advertising, that has been generally sort of accepted, I think, but you know, things might change under a new government. We'll just have to see.
And you will find out all the key developments, the key changes, and lots of expert commentary on the situation in Britain and in Ireland over these crucial coming weeks and months if you sign up to Racing Post Members Club, and details of how to do that are here. Get 50% off your first 3 months in the Racing Post Members Club. As a member, you get access to the digital newspaper exclusively available to members the night before. You'll get daily tips from the likes of Pricewise, Tom Siegel, Robbie Wilders and Paul Keighley. Enjoy award-winning journalism from the industry's best writers and watch replays from all British and Irish racing now available within the Racing Post app. Subscribe today and get 50% off your first 3 months. Welcome back to the Front Page, and now we are going to start talking about horses racing on actual racecourses. And the first racecourse we'll talk about is Newmarket, because across Saturday and Sunday we had the opening two British Classics of 2024, and it's fair to say they did not yield quite what we had expected. On Saturday, City of Troy went to Newmarket in his bid to become a winner of the 2000 Guineas and to confirm the high, lofty, towering reputation that had been built up during a two-year-old campaign that was ended with a mesmerising victory in the Dewhurst Stakes, and Aidan O'Brien talking about him as the horse who never got tired and the best juvenile he had trained. Many people went into the 2000 Guineas thinking City of Troy could end up as the best racehorse Aidan O'Brien had ever trained, but that opinion will have to be revised after 2000 Guineas, in which City of Troy finished only ninth. He was well beaten. He was beaten, in fact, the first horse to be under pressure in the Guineas, and as Ryan Moore was giving him strong encouragement around 2.5 furlongs out to his right-hand side, notable speech breeze alongside under William Bute before going on to win the Classic Redley. Notable speech, a 2000 Guineas winner for Godolphin and a 2000 Guineas winner who broke the mould of 2000 Guineas winners in that he made his racecourse debut as late as Festival Trials Day at Cheltenham, not at Cheltenham, on the all-weather at Kempton, where he won twice more before making his victorious turf debut in the 2000 Guineas. He heads now to Royal Ascot and the St James's Palace Stakes for a fascinating rematch with the Guineas second, Rosalian, who was one of two place horses for Richard Hannon in the Guineas. Harton finished third. Richard Hannon very much bullish and looking forward to that Royal Ascot rematch. We wait to hear more about what happens next, though, for City of True. Had been favourite for the Derby going into the 2000 Guineas, but can now be backed at 8-1. His reputation needs rebuilding. Stable companion Ylang Ylang, however, ran a race full of promise in the 1000 Guineas on Sunday, but she didn't win, and she didn't win a race that again changed our perceptions of what a Newmarket Guineas winner should be, because El Malka was a horse who had made her racecourse debut as late as late November on the sand at Southwell, showing that the changes made there to the all-weather track have already made a big difference. El Malka, a 1000 Guineas winner for Roger Verin, who was winning his first Guineas, and for Sylvester de Souza, it was a first British Classic success and a timely one too, given that almost a year ago he received a 10-month ban in Hong Kong for a betting-related infringement. He's now back in Britain and he is a Classic winner for the first time. There was, however, no Classic success, but immense frustration for supporters of two of the horses just in behind. Ramatuelle, the French raider who'd been so impressive as a juvenile, cruised into the front but around 2.5 furlongs from home under Aurelien Lemaitre and was then caught close home. Perhaps she went too soon, but finishing all too fast and also all too late, but very fast, was Tamfana. Trained by David Menizier, ridden by Jamie Spencer, she came from a mile behind and almost got there, but not quite. So a controversial, fascinating 1000 Guineas weekend. And we'll start with you, DJ, watching from Punchestown. What do you make of the two classics?
How long have you got? Sure, look, you have to start with City of Troy. It's unfortunate for a notable speech that you do have to start with City of Troy, because there's a couple of ways of looking at it. The consensus afterwards seems to be, I even look at this now again, building up this horse to be something that he's not, and why did we listen to this nonsense for the last 6 months or whatever? But the point I would make is, like, he still, for all that City of Troy was obviously hugely disappointing on Saturday, he still was by far the outstanding two-year-old last season. So while Aidan was building it up, the horse was helping to build the hype himself by being, a seriously impressive winner of the Dewhurst. What did I make of the performance? A lot of people on Twitter, it's funny when you click in afterwards and you read the people and they go, he was beating the minute the gates opened, he never looked happy. I was watching from Punchestown and there was maybe 3, 4, 5 of us together in a kind of a hub watching the race. And all of us said almost in tandem after maybe 2 or 3 furlongs, yes, the early splits were quite hectic, so they weren't going pretty quick. But if you're a City of Troy backer after 2.5 furlongs or 3 furlongs, you were quite happy. You were kind of going, looks in his comfort zone. He's not keen. He's in front. He's exactly where I want him to be. He broke fine. And everything seemed to be okay. It was just from that, four furlong pole to 3 furlong pole that the distress signals were sent out so rapidly and, it was like a stone going through water. He looked small and he looked slow. Not a great combination when you're talking about a horse that we're hoping to emulate Frankel. Now, I thought it was very interesting when Francesca Camani put it to Aidan that she was surprised in the ring how small City of Troy looked in comparison to some of the other runners in the Classic. And Aidan, batted it straight back and was like, no, you stand into him. He's 16-1. You won't believe it when you stand into him, how big he is. So that was interesting. But a lot of, paddock observers seem to think that he didn't look imposing in the ring beforehand. I said last year going into the Derby that I thought this is fabulous after timing here now. But I said August Rodin can win the Guineas because it is Aidan O'Brien. And he has done miraculous things over the years with horses who have ran shockers and then bounced back to win big races. And we've seen it over and over. And he did it last year twice or three times with August Rodin. If he gets City of Troy to win a Derby, if he gets City of Troy to win a Derby on the back of that performance, he is God, officially God, because there is no way in this world that City of Troy can win a Derby on the back of that performance, because it was just about everything you didn't want to see in a Derby horse. So the next few weeks are going to be utterly fascinating to see what kind of salvage job Aidan can do with City of Troy. It would be amazing if he did it. And I'd say we said it last year with Augusto Arenado, probably his greatest ever training achievement. But I'll be fascinated to see what he can do. As regards to winner, I remember when he ran in Trials Day, because a fella told me that Andrew Balling had a horse in that race at Kempton that he thought would win, and thought it was his best fancy of that Trials Day. This guy was at Cheltenham, and he said Andrew Balling is a horse running at Kempton later tonight, a horse called Parkland. And he said, this will win because the Godolphin thing at Newcombe will need to be pretty special to beat him, because he thought he ran a lovely race in his debut at Chelmsford. And he was beaten, I think, a length and a quarter, Parkland was. So how unlucky was that guy to bump into a notable speech? But real smooth performance, you know, travelled beautifully, settled beautifully, did everything right. And yeah, I wouldn't like to be, I know Rosalian was a real strong traveller and, you know, did everything right as well. But, you know, if both of these bump into one another again in the St. James's Palace Stakes, I think notable speech will confirm the form. I thought he was a real rock-solid winner, to be honest.
DJ, we're going to talk about the 1,000 guineas in a second, but before I do, I want to go to Bill to get his take on the 2,000. Before I do that, I want to ask you one last question. We spoke about the City of Troy and the Derby. If I said to you, City of Troy, will he win another race? What would you say?
I would say at this moment in time, no. Good question. Will he run in another race? I suppose that's another question.
You've got this.
Well, I suppose one question answers the other. So if I don't think he'll run in another race, I don't think he'll win another race. I don't know. See, your initial reaction afterwards was, and you know, it was too bad to be true and something must have gone wrong. And hopefully I'm working today, so I'll be talking to Aidan maybe later on in the day just to see did anything surface afterwards. But you're talking about this absolutely outstanding juvenile who we thought, you've seen the front page of the Racing Post on Saturday, we thought he was the next Wonder Horse. We were making comparisons with Frankel. And, you know, for him to go from there to like, way down there on the floor so quickly in the space of a minute and a bit. It's worrying. Do I think he'll win another race? If he was with any other trainer, I'd say no. He's with Aidan O'Brien, maybe still no, but it's only because he's with Aidan O'Brien that I'm considering that he will win another race. I do hope we see him again, and I hope he's able to somehow recapture that form from last season, but it's going to take one hell of an effort in Ballydoyle.
Yeah, it will. Bill, for the two superpowers, or the two traditional superpowers of flat racing, they were very different on the weekend. For Charlie Appleby and for Godolphin, a huge win with notable speech. And for the Appleby team, 2023 didn't go well by their own high standards and high expectations. This, therefore, was a key success for them.
Yeah, absolutely. They seem to have an awful lot of good three-year-olds, certainly. I think I'd be with DJ about the St. James's Palace. You can see why Rosalian, with that run under his belt and quicker ground maybe at Ascot, could get closer. When I was watching the race, I was watching Rosalian thinking, oh, he's going to win. And then I looked to the left and saw William Buick coming. I thought it was interesting. Richard Hannon said that with Rosalian, they'd look at the Breeders' Cup mile and sort of work back that fast ground, and he's got to turn a foot. But I did think that the Breeders' Cup mile would be the perfect race for notable speech, because you, with those sort of tight tracks and short straights in America, you need that sort of touch button acceleration.
He's got it.
And the winner's definitely got that. So, yeah.
One thing, Lee, I would say about the winner, I thought, obviously, the performance showed us plenty that we didn't know beforehand. But one thing, like post-race interviews sometimes are boring because, you know, jockeys just say what they're supposed to say. And, you know, you could nearly guess beforehand what a jockey is going to say after winning a race. But I thought William Buick, when he was interviewed, I'm nearly certain it was Ollie Bell on ITV. But I think he said it was something along the lines of, you know, I've been going to bed, you know, wondering, what am I going mad here? Like, because I think this horse is really special and could win a guineas, even though he's only ran on the all weather. And you can almost see the emotion in his face, as, and like, he's a pretty cool character, William. But he was obviously thinking over the last few weeks since that debut in January that we have something like out of this world here. But like, how could he be out of this world? Because he only started in January. He's only ran in the all weather. Like, I'm going mental here because I think he's going to win the Guineas. And that's the way the interview played out in my mind, that they knew they had something absolutely out of this world. But because he'd been running against, you know, vastly inferior opposition in the all weather, they couldn't really say it and they couldn't really think it, even though they wanted to think it. So I would suggest his work, and especially that piece of work that they were talking about at Newmarket last week, I'd suggest it was something really special. And I would say he could be pretty special as well, this horse.
Yeah, Bill, a different sort of 2000 Guineas winner in notable speech, but also in El Malca as well, winner of the 1000 Guineas. She's a filly who began her racing career at late November, when the turf season again was already over, at Southwell, a track we've never associated with potential classic aspirants, but the change to the racing surface there made by the Arena Racing Company has clearly already had a significant impact. A filly who Roger Varian was open in saying that straight after that race, pro punter Mike Spence called him and said she'll win the 1000 Guineas, train like a 1000 Guineas filly. He did. He took a bit of convincing, but recent work after the Fred Darling persuaded Roger that she really was worthy of going for the race. So big win for him, big win for Sylvester D'Souza, who again, just over a year ago, his career was not going in the right direction after that big Hong Kong ban. Again, a classic full of rich stories.
Yes, absolutely. It's obviously my attention has sort of at the Racing Post has strayed somewhat from what happens on the track to what's happening off it. So my knowledge of the form book isn't perhaps as encyclopedic as it once
Don't
was.
Don't beat yourself down.
But it was, it was a funny, I thought it was a funny race, the 1,000 Guineas. You know, I don't want to take anything away from the winner, and I'm sure, you know, there'll be improvement to come. I thought Remachuel should have won it.
Yes.
It's sort of a cliche, isn't it, for the British journalists slag off French jockeys, and I don't really want to slag him off because she was going so well. I can understand why he kicked when he did on her, but if he'd have hung on for a bit, I think she would have won. There was all sorts of interesting performances in there. Tamfana looks a very promising filly. Ilang Ilang ran a really good Oaks trial. It was an interesting race. Quite how the form will stand up, it'll be interesting to see as we go through the season, I think.
Yeah, DJ, Bill mentioned Remachuel. I was a Remachuel backer. I thought when she cruised into the lead, and I thought at the time she was going a long way out, and perhaps the timing of that move made the difference between victory and defeat. But who was more unlucky, Remachuel or Tamfana?
Oh, Tamfana. It would be a pretty good debate and a pretty good race to decide what was the worst ride in the 1000 Guineas, because I suppose if you could put a little bit of Jamie Spencer into Lemaitre and a little bit of Lemaitre into Jamie Spencer, we would have had a great race between the first and the fourth, who would have been probably nicely clear of everything else. It was one of them races. I can fully understand why you were devastated after the race, because it did look over with Remachuel. He tried to take the bull by the horns and say, right, we're going to win this race and we're going to go early. It was a little bit like Running Line earlier in the card, where I have no idea why Oisin Murphy kicked so early on Running Line. Like, I was watching it going, oh my God, like, you're half a mile from home here and you're kicking clear. Like, on that filly's first start of the season, I thought that was bizarre, and a bit like Remachuel as well. But Tamfana, I did the Morning Post on Saturday, and Maddie Playle was on it on Sunday. And she was making a case for Tamfana, and she was making a pretty good case at 66, I think it was at the time. And I actually went back and watched her runs then on the back of that, and yeah, she certainly spotted something. And Tamfana, it wasn't just one of these where, you know, the horse was unlucky in running and flew home, and that can happen. It was, the horse travelled beautifully to a point, and then it was like as if Jamie who usually will try and weave his way through and, you know, track one horse and then get on the back of another horse and then track through and that. It was like, right, we're traveling. And then it was like, and then straight out to the wide outside to get clear ground to run at them. And, like, that horse was in front in another 10 yards. Like, I thought it was an extraordinary performance. Now, maybe it might turn out to be one of these just pure, you know, luckless runs and you know, when she does get a clear run, she mightn't be as good as she looked when she got unlucky. But to me, watching the race, she looked like the best filly in the race, Campana. It'll be interesting. These rematches are going to be fascinating because the winner did really well to win as well. And if there wasn't so many hard luck stories in the race, we'd be saying the winner did exceptionally well to win. And it's only afterwards, I always think with the guineas, because there's so many unexposed horses in these races, after the race, you feel like an idiot because the winner... If you go back and watch that Southern performance, or Southwell as you call it, and this pro punter said to Roger Varian, this filly could win the 1,000 guineas, you can certainly see where she's coming from because it's so hard to make ground at Southern these days. And, you know, she turned in last. She was on the outside, or second last. She was on the outside. She literally went diagonally to the inside and won snugly. And then she went to Newbury. And I was so engrossed in Relief Rally, wondering why on earth was Tom Marquand not trying to make his move on Relief Rally earlier to get out and win the race. Like, she was by far the best filly at Newbury as well. And I know, I think Kevin Blake tipped her and a few other different tipsters tipped her as well. And it was one of them after the race where you kind of go, if you watch her first two runs, you could definitely make a proper case for her. But I suppose that's the case. I fancy Dan Sequence, and Dan Sequence didn't show her true form on the track, I think. But yeah, so many. I think the 1,000 guineas, I've never known a classic to leave us with so many questions rather than answers.
Which is what makes this sport so utterly fascinating. We'll be talking more about big action on the track in the final part of the programme. Before we do that, we have some news here on Free Bets. Welcome back to the Front Page, and we're going to finish it by talking about the Punchestown Festival. As ever, a great 5 days at a fantastic track, and David Jennings, a great 5 days for Willie Mullins, but perhaps not as great a 5 days as we might have expected.
Yeah, our expectations are so high these days, Lee, that we just expect him to have trebles and four-timers on every day at Punchestown, but it didn't quite happen this year. I suppose the main story and the main theme of the week from our point of view was Townend and Jack Kennedy. Two great guys, two terrific jockeys. And Jack obviously went into the week 7 in front. And we wondered whether it would be enough. Like, I think at the start of the week, Townend was clinging on to favouritism, even though he was so far behind. And it was one of them, you're looking through his rides and you're going, well, you know, Statement is an absolute certainty, Ballyburn is a certainty, and you're going through and just wondering how many absolute certainties he had. And unfortunately for Paul, possibly two of the absolute certainties didn't win. Gaelic Warrior was the first of them, obviously. And when Gaelic Warrior was beaten, I think it was a real uh-oh for Paul, kind of thinking, I'm going to do really well to catch Jack here. That was a real turning point. And then obviously Gallop in the Champs was beaten by Faster Slow once again, and that was a real turning point. And I will come to my reasoning why those horses were beaten in a second. But just to touch on Jack, I was there on Saturday, and just to see the contrast in emotions between Gordon Elliott and Jack Kennedy was fascinating. Like, I've rarely seen Gordon so emotional. Like, and people criticise Gordon and they say, you know, he can often be rough and ready and stuff. But there is a soft side to Gordon Elliott that we see every so often. And we did see that at Punchestown on Saturday. Like, he was properly in tears. Like, and then when the camera came on, he was trying to fight back the tears, and he was an emotional wreck. So he was, because I think he kind of see, I suppose, when a jockey like Jack Kennedy comes to a yard at 14 years of age, like, you're taking a lot of responsibility with you there. And Gordon was, this would have been still reasonably young, obviously in his 30s at the time, and he played a kind of a father-like figure to Jack. And I can imagine over the years, Jack has had so many injuries, broken his leg so many times and had so many different injuries. And I'd imagine Gordon has had to play that role of father figure with him a little bit as well. And I always thought when Jack got injured, it was interesting always to hear Gordon straight away. Once Jack is back, he's back on them. Doesn't matter what happens, doesn't matter how any rider does, once Jack is fit and ready, he's back on these horses. And I think that played a huge part in Jack's confidence as well. And to touch on the emotions between the pair, Gordon was fighting back tears. And I said in my piece on Sunday, writing about Saturday, I said Jack just looked like he like won a fiver after getting 3 out of 5 numbers up in his local lotto. He was like, oh, grand, yeah, it's great, you know, great to win, you know. And Jack talks so slow and his delivery is so slow and he's just so laid back. It's like as if, well, sure, look, this was what I was born to do, lads, and, you know, I'm delighted, you know. But he's a lovely, lovely guy, a terrific rider, and just to see like the difference in emotions, I thought was terrific. But just to touch on, fair play to Jack, well done to Paul, you know, two great ambassadors who you know, bounced off one another really well and obviously get on great. I think they sit very close to each other in the weighing room as well. So great race, and great to see you going into the final stages of the season. And Jack's only 25, so we're going to have plenty more of these battles to come. So fair play. 123 to 121, like, that's phenomenal numbers in Irish racing, especially where we don't have as many jumps meetings as Britain. Just to touch on Gallop and the Champs and Gaelic Warrior, I think we know now there's sufficient evidence in both cases to know the deeper the ground, the more unbeatable those horses are. I think when it gets to the end of the season, I think it's not end of season tiredness. I think it's a ground factor. I think Gallop and the Champs is a different beast when there's plenty of cut in the ground. And he's obviously got that in the Gold Cup in March. Faster, slow, kind of left you feeling kind of like, you know, oh, what would have happened in the Gold Cup if he stood up? I do think it was a different Gallop and the Champs at Punchestown to the one that won the Gold Cup at Cheltenham, though, and the same with Gaelic Warrior. I don't think both of them ran their races, but that's what can happen at Punchestown. We have these strange results, and Martin Brazel, a bit like Jack Kennedy, real cool customer, just gets on with the job, doesn't make any fuss about it. And I said it in a piece afterwards as well, I genuinely cannot believe that Gallop and the Champs is not favourite for next year's Gold Cup. I've never known recency bias to take over a market as much as the 2025 Gold Cup. How Factophile, who was reasonably impressive in a Brown Advisory, that's form has, you know, taken a knock since, with Monty Starr being beaten and obviously, unfortunately, the Lucinda Russell horse being beaten is no longer with us. But yeah, I think Gallop and the Champs should be favoured. I think we owe him that. I think he's at Cheltenham when there's cut in the ground in March rather than, you know, May as it was this year, or late April. I think he's a beast on deep ground. I think he should be still favoured for the Gold Cup.
And therefore, are you backing him at 4-1 now, DJ?
No, because, you know, will I even be alive next March? I have no idea. A lot can change in the space of 10 months, and I would never be one for dabbling in anti-post markets this early. Yes, when Up in the Ante comes around next November, I'll be strongly considering it, because I presume he'll be the same price then as he is now. But I just thought when the markets came through, I was like, God, this is some overreaction. Like, and the thing I loved about Gallop and the Champs, and I'm not taking anything away from Faster Slow, who was a brilliant winner in the race, and, you know, what a horse he is to come from a handicapper and to be beaten in an ultimate to win 2 Punchestown Gold Cups. But just have a look at the last 100 yards in the Punchestown Gold Cup again. Just watch it again and you say to yourself, yes, Faster Slow, a brilliant winner, but Gallop and the Champs, who hadn't jumped as well as he can, hadn't travelled as well as he can, in those last 100 yards, boy, did he try. He gave absolutely everything and was closing down Fast or Slow again at the line. I love when champions do that. I love even when they're beaten to say, well, I'm just going to give this one last try just in case I get there. And watch that last 100 yards of the Punchestown Gold Cup again and you'll realise why Gallop and the Champs is one of the best horses of the modern era. I thought it was a, you know, real gutsy effort on an off day to get as close to Fast or Slow after the last. I thought it was a heroic enough effort personally, and I think he should be favoured for the Gold Cup.
Well, like Gallop and the Show, I think David Jennings and Bill Barber have been heroic through this edition of the Front Page. They could not have tried harder. They have given their all, and it is my duty now to decide which of them, or perhaps even me, has won this week's edition. I thought there were great guineas at Newmarket. Lots of fascinating stories and subplots within them. It was another super Punchestown festival with, again, great human and equine stories to reflect on. But Bill, you don't come along here very often. You've made the effort on a bank holiday, and I think given the gravitas and the serious nature of the affordability check story, I think you have to win. But DJ, as you also got involved with the stuff on the gambling regulation bill, which again is of massive importance, I think it's fair to say you are both joint winners and I am your loser. Thank you. That then is the end of this week's show. I thank David Jennings. I thank Bill Barber. I thank you for watching. We shall return next week with lots of important things to discuss. Until then, have a great week and bye-bye.